Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner: Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Lamker, Assistant Professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And for this episode, I have the honor to welcome Benedikt Schmid from the University of Freiburg in Germany.
Hi, first of all, thanks for inviting me. I'm really glad to be here. As you said, I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Freiburg, and I work on issues around post-growth, specifically from a geography perspective.
You have been involved in two working groups, actually, in book projects organized mainly, let's say, from the German-speaking parts of Europe within the Academy for Territorial Development in the Leibniz Association, short ARL, in Germany. And in post-growth geographies, that was a couple of years ago, and well-being alternatives very recently, you engaged with major foundations of post-growth and their spatial implications. Can you briefly tell us what was the aim of these working groups and what brought courage to embark this in these directions?
I would say in general, the key potential of these working groups is that they bridge academic and practical work on various topics. So post-growth being an integrated issue requires a particularly close kind of connection of theoretical work and work on the ground. I remember, for instance, one planner at a conference saying that about post-growth, it all sounds nice, but what am I going to do when I go back to the office next Monday? And I think this captures the aim of our working groups quite well, to develop feasible pathways towards post-growth futures.
Yeah, I can well imagine this has also shaped your perspective on spatial planning, coming maybe more from geography in Freiburg. What would you then say are the key challenges for daily planning practices for today, for moving towards post-growth?
As I don't have a background in planning, as you said, so I'm a geographer, we of course have a lot to do with space and planning. I think, first of all, this kind of allowed me to get many insights into different aspects of planning. And key challenges, I would say, are quite different. First, I think it's a matter of mental infrastructure. So what are the norms when it comes to envisioning what our cities should look like? What are common practices when it comes to planning and implementing those visions? So post-growth planning would mean to do things very differently and imagine things very differently. Second, I think it's a matter of material infrastructures. It would be much easier to work on a blank slate rather than a living city that is laid out in a specific way and that can't hold its breath until you've fundamentally changed it. And third, and maybe most importantly, I would say that it's a question of institutional arrangements. We have strong incentive structures to do things in a growth-oriented way, to demolish instead of renovate, to develop new areas, to attract businesses and wealthy residents, and to continue focusing on car-based mobility, for example. And I guess the hardest thing of all is that all of these areas have to be addressed simultaneously for things to change in a post-growth direction.
Yeah, most recently, 2024, your work resulted even in a handbook chapter called Urban Degrowth. If you look back at your experiences, are cities more the cause of the problem of growth, or are cities the key solution?
Yeah, this is difficult to say. Maybe in and of themselves, I would see cities neither as a cause nor a solution. I would rather say that cities are maybe part of or an expression of more complex societal issues that are built around growth. And cities, of course, are part of that. So, of course, in a way, cities are implicated in kind of growth-based societies. So they are some sort of a like cause of the problem. In cities, this is where much of the value creation happens. This is where much of the energy and material is used and much of the waste is produced. And also, of course, where a lot of power is concentrated. And I guess for the same reason, cities might also be part of a solution. So this is where a lot, like cities, is where a lot of the creativity to organize our economies differently comes from. This is where power relations can be challenged and changed, and also resources can be redistributed differently, and also where much of the potential to reduce material and energy footprint, of course, is located. So yeah, in a way, I wouldn't like pick a side on this, but I would say that cities are maybe both simultaneously and maybe none of them, because of course, like growth is goes much beyond what we would call cities.
Yeah, and preparing for our talk today, I read into your recent works and I've seen that you also moved to practical applications or examples in cities like Berlin, Amsterdam, Barcelona, but also, let's say, closer to yourself, to the city of Freiburg, especially in an article you co-authored called Towards a Freiburg Model of Housing for the Common Good, Fostering Collaborative Housing in Urban Development. Housing, quite a crucial topic in a wide array of degrowth debates. But how do you see personally housing as a crucial topic when moving towards post-growth futures?
Maybe I should lead with saying that I'm always struggling to select a specific area to focus on, as I think all aspects of our daily lives are highly relevant, be it food, mobility, everyday goods and services, or housing. But housing, of course, is a key issue from various angles. So, from energy and material use during construction and operation to the incredible injustices when it comes to affordability and accessibility. So I would say there are many reasons to focus on housing from a post-growth perspective, but maybe if I had to single out some specific areas, I guess construction as being one of the sectors with the highest use of materials and energy, and being responsible for a lot of land use changes. So I think it's much about maybe talking about renovation and redistribution rather than still further expanding housing and adding more housing than there's already there. I guess this is also related to a second aspect, dysfunctional housing markets that are often being portrayed as being the result of a lack of supply of housing. So in other words, the response that is discussed is to just build more. But we rarely talk about the stark increase of living space per capita, which is highly unevenly distributed, and also about the immense transfer of money from renters to large homeowners. And then I guess a third area, we also see very inspiring examples in the area of housing, how things actually can be changed. For instance, when we look at housing cooperatives or the Mietshäuser-Syndikat, here communities take housing out of the market, so it's no longer a commodity to make profits, but a good that fulfills a human need for shelter, community, and much more. So I think we can also take a lot of kind of positive inspirations from the area of housing specifically.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly agree that housing as a pure commodity is a false way to think about the future, and also that in principle we never had more housing than today. So this solution must go deeper than just adding more of the same. In this vein, in the recent article that I will also put to the notes of this episode, you explain how a broad idea of the common good can relate to housing practices. Common good also quite crucial for planning over longer history. How would you then anchor the common good in post-growth futures?
So yeah, it's not easy to talk about common good. It is a contested term, but I think it's quite useful. First of all, we actually chose the term common good because it was the wording used by the city of Freiburg in this specific case you refer to. It's a district development project of a district called Klein Eschholz, and the city of Freiburg announced that the development of this district shall be 100% oriented towards the common goods. So they wanted to develop exclusively with organizations and groups that have an explicit common good orientation. And I think this orientation, coming to more closely to post-growth, decidedly differs from one that centers on markets, for which, of course, return on invest is a key criterion. And here, if we reorientate housing towards the common good, we put specific needs at the center and not an abstract monetary value. In the case of Klein Eschholz, this shall be achieved through the use of concept-based tendering. So the idea is that housing groups can develop their concepts and they lay out what kind of houses and communities they want to build, and the city decides which are the most, let's say, convincing concepts. And aside from sustainability and affordability, which are important aspects, the value of proposals for well, the added value that these proposals bring to the district and the city as a whole are key evaluation criteria. It's actually a nice kind of time to talk about this because the final decision about what projects actually made it will be made in a few days in the city council. There is already a kind of a list out there, but so we are talking about this in a very kind of timely manner. And I think there are still many things that will need to, like, time will tell, but I think Klein-Eschholz is on a way to becoming a kind of at least an inspiration or a model district where a lot of the people who will eventually live there are actually key actors in the process right now. They contribute to the design, to the organization, and they will eventually be both, like many of them will both be renters and owners. So it's very exciting to see this project unfolding.
So as you say, it's too early to evaluate, especially as nothing has yet been materialized and many decisions are just on the way. Nevertheless, Freiburg is usually not highest on the international agenda, maybe for finding the solutions to housing crisis, though it has a history for being recognized as a green city, as experimenting with housing solutions. So what do you say, which inspirations can or should planning practitioners and other cities take from what is currently happening in Freiburg and also what you observe there in your own research?
First of all, I would like to mention that Freiburg is the origin of the Mietshäuser-Syndikat. So, and this is an organization that has an idea that has spread quite broadly. So I guess there is merit in looking at Freiburg, at least for some inspiration. But also, if we look more broadly at how most of the housing is organized, it seems to me that it makes huge sense to shift the focus more generally to cooperative forms of housing. And I see this happening in various places. And it, again, it completely makes sense to me, because why would a city seek to develop more housing where rents are high so that investors can take their share? To me, it seems much more sensible that, especially in a context where you have a really strong alternative housing landscape, such as in Freiburg, to build close alliances, because at the end, I think a lot of the goals of what the city, like long, at least if it thinks long term, of what cities have and what housing groups have, they share a lot of common interests. Many of them want to create sustainable housing, they want to create just housing. And I think what is needed, and this also would be one of the lessons learned from the Freiburg case, is that there is a lot of openness and communication needed from both sides. So, of course, it's too early to tell if everything went according to plan. And there's also, I guess, there are also some valid criticisms on the case in Freiburg. But overall, it seems to be quite successful. And one of the reasons for this is that the city and housing groups were in really close conversation during the entire process. And I think this can be valuable and something that can also be transferred to other places.
Yeah, so far we are talking about examples, ideas, initiatives that more or less work in an existing environment, taking up a mix of goals, focusing on the common good, but let's say less touching upon more fundamental dimensions. In some of your articles, you also engage deeper with the limits of capitalism and the potential of post-capitalist futures in relation to post-growth. In literature, I observe, and I also have this tension in myself, that there's both ways, putting emphasis on what can we do within planning, within the current system, fostering kind of these niches, growing them, finding alternatives, or focusing on the constraints, the limits of the overarching capitalist system as a whole. What would you say? How far can we change roles and practices within spatial planning as it is, let's say? That's what I understand what the Freiburg case also does so far, without challenging the wider forces of capitalism as a whole.
I maybe you can start by thinking a little bit outside this language of systems. So if we change the role and practices of spatial planning in ways that foreground sustainability and justice, that enhance the common good, as we've talked about, that maybe puts people's needs at the center of planning. Who cares what we would call the system that is the result of this? I doubt that it would be called, or it could be called, capitalism, but maybe if we little bit step away from this more kind of systemic language. And of course, I see the merit of being critical towards structures and engaging in structural analysis. But I also think that the everyday planning that is done contributes fundamentally to the way systems are produced and reproduced. So I think what we need to overcome is a logic of capital that deeply influences all parts of our lives, our planning, our decision making. But if we think about the roles and practices, maybe the language of systems is not always helpful, because the system can quickly feel almighty and maybe even keep us from seeing the ways in which we can change things. And I would say, if we maybe go back to this case in Freiburg that we just talked about, I don't think that a lot of the practices, even they kind of happened within current planning systems, I think a lot of the practices are, they're not like people arguing or engaging from like a capitalist perspective. They are not maybe too happy with what is going on. There are also attempts, actually, because the whole project was oriented towards the common good. There were attempts to include by investors to also submit proposals, and luckily they didn't succeed. But so I think there is an interest, of course, still. It's a very nice located district in Freiburg, where also money could be made, but the way this planning was set up within the current system points beyond the current system in a way. So I would say that yes, we need to be critical towards capitalist relations. We need sometimes to take a systemic view, but we should be careful not to let the systemic view cloud the many different ways that are possible, even within current structures, to do things differently that are potentially transformative beyond capitalism.
If you look at the practices you are observing in housing and the examples in Freiburg, do they somehow lead to shifting boundaries within the existing system, produce some cracks? Or would you say there are certain points where it's visible that they succeed in a way, but then that they reach a limit and would need other kinds of systemic conditions, other structural support to move further? And kind of foster the common good at a wider scale, let's say.
Yeah, this is a really good question. I would say that, of course, and kind of thinking about what I've just said, that I think there are a lot of ways in which maybe those practices, and again, it's really difficult to say that if we look at, like, if we are situated within these dynamics while they are unfolding, it's really difficult to tell what eventually will lead to change and what will not. I think, like, if we think about the district that will hopefully emerge in the way that it's planned right now, that this will be really a step away from a logic of capital towards a logic of the common good. But at the same time, there are many restraints. For example, we talk about financing, and one idea of the district originally was that they wanted to make use of leasehold principles. So they didn't want to sell the properties, but actually they want to lease them for, I think, a period of 99 years. But then it turned out that actually supporting structures didn't really pay enough attention to the possibility of leasehold principles. So they kind of took a step back to actually selling the properties with having a repurchase right on part of the city, because it wasn't reflected enough in current funding structures that there is actually such an option. So we kind of see regularly that there are attempts of maybe expanding the possible and moving towards the boundaries and maybe even beyond that. But then, of course, we always see cases where there actually are some limits being hit, and it's really difficult to actually go through with it and move beyond them. So I guess at the end, it's I think of it as an iterative process, because if we run against those limits, we also have a chance to make the limits visible and maybe to change them in the long run. And at the same time, of course, immediately we need to kind of find ways to navigate the limits of what is possible. So I think like cases like Freiburg, and sorry to come back to that case, but it seems to be such a good example for so many things. These compromises and more, let's say, seeing what is possible is badly needed to actually make visible what the limits of the system are, and also to expand the space of what is possible to do within current structures to eventually, hopefully, move beyond them.
Yeah, if I think of more practical debates, it takes quite some courage to expand the possibilities, to think maybe towards the edges of what is possible. Which options do you see to convince, also beyond a single example, in light of such a challenge, to at least try and move towards these boundaries and maybe expand the space of what is deemed possible?
I think I would always start by asking, what is the ultimate goal that one wants to achieve? Is it profit, growth, or investments, or isn't it rather enabling a good life now and in the future for as many people as possible? And I know that this is easier said than done. So there are many regulations, as we've talked about. There are many proceedings and constraints that planners face. But also I see a lot of leeway for creativity, and there are inspiring examples out there. So I guess what I would say is that, and this is, at the end, a very kind of also individual decision, because we are all situated in different corners of the system. So I guess what I would like to say, it's important to be very critical, or to adopt a very critical perspective in terms of thinking, in terms of questioning what are the goals that we want to pursue, and at the same time that we are not afraid of actually making compromise in practice, because I guess at the end it is often kind of a navigation between what is possible within the systems and the broader goals that we pursue. So I guess it would be a little bit strange to have a clear answer to this, but for me it's to be courageous, to engage in reflection, to question the goals that are out there, and really to be critical and to think about what are the possibilities within my everyday practices that I can shift towards pursuing transformative goals rather than reproducing the existing system.
Yeah, from your advice, your experience, or also from maybe what you observe at a university, what you observe in research and education, do you have a more specific advice to a planner today to take up the courage and at least experiment in some ways in the given option space that is available?
So I would say that it, and a little bit coming back to one of the lessons from the Freiburg case, that it is, in my perspective, hugely helpful to talk to many different people from many different backgrounds. And I think this is something that can be done. Of course, there are also time constraints, but this can be done by planners from various locations and various kind of positions, to try to listen to those who are affected, who are involved in planning decisions, and listen to what they have to say, what the wishes are, what the potentials are, and the capabilities. I think there's also a lot to be learned to how can we plan cities to actually allow people's creativity and people's to create opportunities that people can actually bring in their capacities to making this lively neighborhood, lively city. So I guess asking questions and listening to people would be one step that I guess most of us would be able to implement.
We are moving to a positive outlook to also the potentials that planning actually has to improve to the better, to engage with ideas to improve situations of housing, but also other urban and non-urban challenges. And to the very end, in this podcast, we use the term post-growth planning since many years already. And in each episode towards the end, we asked a guest to finish the sentence with the definition post-growth planning is.
Post-growth planning is planning that decenters economic growth as institutionalized principle and instead foregrounds human needs, ecological sustainability, and social justice.
Benedikt, many thanks for sharing your insights from Freiburg, your thoughts on housing, on urban degrowth, on post-growth, on capitalism with us. And many regards to Freiburg and all the best for also your coming writing projects, your coming research projects, and all your engagement for the topic of post-growth.
So, thank you very much for having me in this podcast. I'm a big fan. I've listened to a lot of the previous episodes. So thank you very much.
Thank you.